This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. You will explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. And in the spirit of an enlightened future, TrekFan is absolutely free. Not just free to play, but completely free. Find out more by visiting fm.trekfan.org.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and this week we are going to continue with part two of our discussion about the casting of DS9 and the development of characters with Larry Nemechek. Last week we brought you part one, and we left off as Larry and I were talking about Dr. Julian Bashir. So here you go, we're going to pick back up where we left off, and I'll see you on the other side. Well, you kind of growled a moment ago, and it reminded me of Odo. So let's talk about Odo for a minute. And I remember when DS9 came on, and I saw Clayton Endicott III from Benson on Star Trek. Of course, Rene Auberjonois, or how do you pronounce his last name exactly? I'm sure I always mispronounce it.
I say Auberjonois.
Okay.
Yeah.
He had been on many, many shows, of course, on MASH as well.
And, right, the movie famous, MASH.
The movie MASH, yes, as Father Mulcahy, right?
The original Father Mulcahy, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so he was very well known before Star Trek.
Done a lot of theater in New York.
Did they have him in mind for the show? I mean, obviously, they knew about his career going into this. Was he someone that they had identified as, we want to write a role for him?
None of these, aside from like Rolar and O'Brien, were written for anybody. They were cast, and then they had pleasant surprises. But, you know, one of the hallmarks of DS9's cast was, we keep talking about these people were theater people, and I don't know if it's because the nature of DS9 was, you know, when you're looking for texture and grittiness and shadows and you know, the darker, grittier show, as they kept, that was became the shorthorn for the show, that as opposed to TNG at the time, that drove everybody crazy after that became the meme.
Right.
But maybe it's something about texture and depth, and that, you know, maybe that's what it was that drew all these stage. I mean, you know, like obviously Sid was kind of a younger actor. That's what the role called for, Bashir called for. But most of the cast were these great stage veterans. And again, yeah, and Renee is somebody that's running back and forth. I mean, he'd been acting since the 60s, most of it on stage. But I just think maybe that was just like the filter. It's the same way with the better alien actors that have to, you know, act under the prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got our Ferengi and our Cardassians and Klingon actors that we all love who are great actors, it's like they have to work double hard to get through the mask.
Yeah.
And have it. And when they can, when you find somebody that can do that, oh my God, they must be a really, really good actor anyway. So, I'm just really glad they did find him. I'm not sure how long the process was, but I get the idea. There's only one of the cast that we haven't talked about yet. There's only one of the cast that I think they had trouble finding an actor for. You know, we're not talking about Catherine Janeway territory here.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing goes to Catherine Janeway territory as far as casting. But there's only one character still in the cast that we haven't talked about yet that was really a late comer just because they were casting and casting and casting and trying to get to it.
And I'm sure that's Jadzia Dax. But before we get to Jadzia, though, I want to talk about one other stage veteran who actually had worked with Renee in the past, and that's Armin Shimerman as Quark.
Right.
And of course, he had played Ferengi in the fateful outing, The Last Outpost, comes back to completely redeem the Ferengi in my eyes and is a very important part of Deep Space Nine as Quark. So he got the role. Now, did they bring him back because he had played a Ferengi before? And they forgave him for being under the direction that he was under for The Last Outpost, or what?
Well, that was, you know, that was first season, and 5 years had gone by, and TNG was on top of the ratings. So I think come home, all is forgiven. no, I mean, it's kind of like the Ferengi became a little bit like the Klingons, or the Vulcans. It's kind of like there's a pool of actors, even though they don't like to repeat people in the same, species. They like to shop it around. There are people that have become the go-to family of actors. I mean, you look at the cast, you look at the credits, and there's 5, 6, 7 guys that routinely they tried to space it out. And they tried to if he was one of the furry guys before we came up with the refined Damon suit, then we'll have him be a Damon. Or it's been 3 years, 4 years, we can have him be something we wrote the Ferengi crappy in the early years, now we've got them being a little more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
But for one reason or another, there's a pool of, part of it is the height. They would go to shorter guys, obviously, and gals, if they had gals. But they would go to shorter actors, and it's got to be an actor that can play through the mask, can get through the makeup. And, the Klingon actors tend to be a certain body type and, personality, or at least an actor that's versatile to carry that off. And the Cardassians and the Vulcans have a certain, face body structure and bone structure, especially
then,
the Vulcans and Romulans.
And then there's Jeffrey Combs.
I forgot that I was walking into the Jeffrey Combs fan club. No, I love him.
Who can play any role.
And if you talk to him today, he'd say, I agree with you. Now, please tell the casting guys to get me out there. But so Armin... And in fact, Armin actually, in human guise, was also at the time Principal Snyder on Buffy in the early
seasons. Yeah, I remember that.
Buffy. Mm-hmm. And he was, I'm trying to remember his name. He was actually a recurring character on the original Beauty and the Beast series.
Okay.
It was the romance with Ron Perlman and Linda Hamilton, who I've heard it said went on to greater fame in other sci-fi genre shows and series.
All right. But I don't remember that role, but I do remember that he was Kramer's golfing buddy on Seinfeld as well.
Oh, okay. Well,
I actually, I had Armin on about a year or so ago on our other show, Matterstream, and I mentioned that role, and he's like, oh, yes, that's the role. Don't remind me of that.
Don't remind me. That's like remembering Brent Spiner from being the Mr. Wheeler from Night Court, the Hicks.
Yeah, right.
When he got to do his, Okie, Texas accent. But no, so Armin, but Armin's Mr. Theater, Mr. Shakespeare. Yeah. And he's got this incredible stage background, and he can handle it. His part on, it's escaped me, but he was the character that was kind of like the communicator. He kept like the scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the news, he would be like the news editor, the broadcast, whatever. He was the communicator guy. I don't mean sat in a chair with a thing in his ear, but I mean, on their little kind of quasi-medieval underground culture, he was the one that kept the scrolls and was kind of the librarian, a 5 o'clock and all's well kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in that first debut Ferengi show. Now, at the time, he was one of 6 guys in that show, right? 6 Ferengi actors. There were 3 on the planet, maybe 4. 3 on the planet and the 2 or 3 that came, that beamed over. And or they're on the view screen, but he, somewhere between this is his actual guilt he carries around, and maybe just like, oh well, it's been enough years, I can just kind of aggrandize myself here. But he loves to take credit for not doing enough. He loves to take the blame for the Ferengis getting off on the wrong foot, so that he can come back and redeem them with court. Now I know he felt a lot of pressure to redeem the Ferengis. Of course, Michael Piller did too. They both kind of in tandem really wanted Quark to give the Ferengis a second chance at life and respect, which I think they more than pulled off.
Yeah.
Now, here's a place, though. You're talking about casting, though. Here's a place where we do know the casting story, because guess who the runner-up to Armin was for the role?
I want to say it was Renee, wasn't it?
No, it was Max.
Oh, okay.
Max Gradenchik, who played Rom, was the runner-up. The two of them knew that it would be one of the two of them. I think you could just tell Armin's, he just had more roles and was a little more bombastic with it. Although Max can be pretty funny when he's turned on. But it's one of those things where the runner-up made such an impact that they kept him around. And even though he's only down as Ferengi pit boss in the background in the pilot, they actually call him Rom for the first 1 hour. And they bring him in as – because Nog – was down as a recurring character, and Nog is in the pilot, having Aaron Eisenberg play him. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where they have Armin playing Quark, and they say, yes, Quark says, that's my nephew, and Aaron says, uncle. Nog says, uncle. And the whole time you're going, well, if that's his uncle, and that's his nephew, do they live together? He's right. Too young. So is his mother or dad running around? Wait, a mother? That would be Ferengi. That would be interesting. So it's almost like somewhere along the way somebody said, oh, we're going to have to it's almost like Will Wheaton, Wesley Crusher, was the first intention on Next Generation. And somewhere along the way, somebody said, oh, we kind of need to have his mother as at least a recurring character. Before they went, oh, well, she's going to be the doctor. Well, we need to have her be a regular. It's kind of like there've been some backdoor in those early roots of a show. There's some of those things that you kind of go, oh, well, I guess we kind of need to do this. So, yeah. So Nog never got to be regular, obviously, but Max made such an impact they kept him around, and by the second or third show Rom was off and running, and like so many of the recurring people there had his own huge arc over the show, from the dumb, stupid, stereotypically stupid brother to not so stupid and got Leeta and became Negus.
The character evolved so much over the course of the show.
But there's a runner-up story for you in casting.
Well, let's talk about Jadzia, who you mentioned earlier, because yes, this was, there's, I'm, Niners know a bit about her coming in last minute, having to catch up, get her lines, get settled in. They always talk about how difficult it can be to cast female characters, to find an actress who's beautiful and is also a great actress. And, I mean, there are plenty of women out there like that, but it does seem to be harder to find the right person for the right role when they're casting some of these female characters in Star Trek.
Right, and Dax and Terry are on both sides of the character and the actress, both have really good textured histories, too. So, for one thing, they've got Odo as the shapeshifter, and that's going to be kind of interesting right there. And, we got to remember that Terminator 2 had just come out, and that whole melting effect had just dazzled everybody, blown everybody away. So there's a little bit of a, ooh, that's cool. And at the time this was being developed, being affected by that. And it's kind of one of those things where, the creative developers, in this case it's Mike and Rick, Michael Piller and Rick Berman, they can't help but be affected. Ooh, that's science fiction-y. Ooh, that's cool. Ooh, let's do a shapeshifter and use something like that kind of effect. Only instead of, metallic, it's more liquidy. But then somewhere on the way they go, okay, can we afford to do this once a week? Because it's still the 90s. It's pre-CGI. It's, very early. If you have CGI, it's something you spent millions on in a movie for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It's not what you're going to do. You might as well be back in the 60s trying to have a new ship model every week.
Yeah, quickly goes away, doesn't it? It's like, okay, here's the cool effect. And then it's like, you didn't see him do it, but you know he can do it.
Right, right. And they actually did that. Like beaming on some shows. It's like, oh, we heard the transporter going. We didn't do, we always heard the phaser burst.
Oh,
we didn't see it.
But nothing can top Spectre of the Gun with the coat sleeve zoom beaming, where you beam from one place to another by zooming into the rank braids on your sleeve.
I'd forgotten that, but you're absolutely, yeah. You're right there. Yeah. Oh, there was times even on Next Generation where they talk. What I think Jonathan or Brent talk about they're framing the picture where they're like shooting out of frame, like off, and their hand. It's like the picture cuts off at their wrist. because they've lifted the phaser up to the frame, and you just don't see even. I remember somebody saying, you know, phaser blasts are a thousand bucks a shot or something like that. So you know, in 1992 dollars or whatever. But no, so Jadzia, there's that they're looking at their, you know, again, DS9 is the crossroads show. You know, here's the aliens, and we can have friction and we can have conflict and drama because we're not all happy dappy humans here. We're not even all Federation, but the Federation. Let's stretch the envelope a little bit. And they were really, you know, in the same vein as going, "Ooh, that shape shifting thing is cool. Let's come up with a character that way, or maybe that can lead us down that road." Here's two things. You know, the Trills had been established in the host, so that's what, fourth, fifth season, Next Generation. So that was an idea. But even before they did the Trill, as far as, hey, in our stable of human characters, let's have an alien Starfleeter, because we've got the aliens, you know, we've got Quark, we've got Odo, you know, technically we have Kira being Bajoran, but in our human stable, we've got Sisko and Jake, and we've got O'Brien, we've got Bashir. Let's, you know, in our mix of female to males and aliens to humans and all that stuff, let's have an alien female. And the original idea for the science officer was what really became Melora Pazlar.
Right.
I don't know if you knew this or not. Maybe you did. But they were talking about having a person from a low planet background. And that Star Trek thing of kind of maybe having one of the characters represent something of Earth that has changed by that time, kind of like having Geordi be blind and having the visor and having it not be an impediment at all. Having someone, you know, that uses a wheelchair be a character, although it's for a different, completely different alien sci-fi reason. She came from a low planet. She's not really disabled. She's just disabled in a Class M environment with, you know, Earth normal gravity. But they decided that that wheelchair was going to be too much, you know, production overhead to clunk around all the time. Maybe eventually the actress in the part might have, you know, may have come to see that the same way LeVar Burton came to see the visor. Like, gee, can we do a show where I lose my visor? You know, kind of a thing. Not to knock the background that it's giving, you know, inspiration to so many people in the audience, but... Anyway, but they did decide finally that they tossed that character before they got too far along with it and wound up going to the Trill. And but yeah, Terry was a late, as you said, a late addition on that beauty and brains thing. But here's the thing. They put themselves in a box with Dax. It's such a cool sci-fi concept to say that the symbiont is the 300-year-old slug and the outer host body is, you know, they're mixed together. And that the host... changes from that. But here the whole joke that they developed was, in fact, there's earlier writers' guides had Jadzia being bonded with the slug since she was six, and actually the earlier guides had there being a little bit of a romantic chemistry between Sisko and Dax, but then when they came up with the story point about Curzon having just given up the worm a few years earlier, they realized that there couldn't be this, like, Riker, Troy, Decker, Ilia, oh, past romance, which is their first kind of idea.
Yeah.
So they had to go back to, oh, well, if he was a 60, 70, 80-year-old man that was a mentor to, you know, there can't be any residual thing there. And they kind of gave the kind of flirtation-y, you know, chemistry cheat thing to Bashir, at least in the early shows. But the whole point was, so now you've got, here's Dax, Jadzia Dax, is this wise 300-year-old character who's this young, vivacious woman, and what are the dynamics of that? And originally, for the first year or two, Dax, I kept trying to make Terry, make Jadzia be wise Dax. And you can see that in the early shows. And here's this incredible-looking woman being wise Dax. And finally, it took the third year, fourth year, fifth year, before they just kind of gave up and just said, they started calling it Wacky Dax, and LeVar called her Action Barbie by the time they got to the Klingon stuff. But,
oh, really? Action Barbie?
Yeah,
huh?
that was his little nickname for her by the time he was directing shows with Batliff fights with Worf and stuff. Well, from Blood Oath, from Blood Oath onward.
Okay.
So, but if and that you know if he even it's like the last ditch effort on that was if you look at the Defiant when the Defiant comes in the Search, they're still tinkering. This is why I was saying they're messing around with like Kira's hair. Like you know, Janeway wasn't the only one. They were messing around with Dax's hair at the beginning too. And if you look at the last ditch effort on this was the two-parter that opens season three when the Defiant comes.
That was terrible.
And they've got her back in this full head, this full head thing. It's like, not, you know, it's like, really? They're just trying to find little ways to make her, quote unquote, wiser.
That and hero finally was just said, not working. Yeah. So.
It was just weird. But that was like the last time. After that, they just gave up and said, oh, go with it. I mean, Terry came from being a model turned actress, and not to knock anybody, but did not have the depth of the theater training that all the rest of that cast did. And it's a little bit like Jolene in Enterprise that way.
Yeah.
Came in as more of a model without a lot of acting experience. And that's what they cast for, and that's what they wanted. And they kind of eased on. But she worked on her craft, and, you know, after a year or so, she was slinging it with the best of them. But you could see her being tentative in those early shows and grew into it really well. But she was the last one they cast. In fact, I went back and got my call sheets, and it looks like they had like a 22-day shoot, although they went over a few days, I bet. I'm just betting. But just because David Carson shot the hell out of the show. Of course, the pilot was what convinced them to let David Carson have the chance at directing Generations. Because they were on Generations, the first TNG movie, they were really big about trying to give TV people, quote-unquote, a chance at a feature. So...
Mm-hmm.
They wound up taking at least 23 days. But anyway, Dax didn't shoot. Jadzia did. Terry did not shoot until the 11th day of the 22-day shoot. So that's kind of a sign there. And of course, once they finally did cast her, they put her in the forehead that you saw on Odan in The Host back on TNG. And then they were like, well, this is insane. Why did we cast a beautiful woman if we're going to cover her face up?
Yeah.
So, you know, they're running Michael Westmore around in circles. So it's another case of, okay, we're just going to kind of come up with this and not change it. We're going to put these spots, not facial appliances, and we'll just say, you know, we'll let those fans come up with why the Klingons have flat heads and bumpy heads or something. Yeah. You know, it's going to be one of those things.
Well, it's one thing that they learned on DS9, I think, that sometimes less is more, and don't try. It's a science fiction show, but you don't necessarily have to have all of those wrappings, and you see that as the show goes on, where they start to, of all the shows, they use the least amount of technobabble, and they use the least amount of crazy explanations for why something is happening, right?
Well, right, and part of that is Michael. Here's the thing that I don't really remember this big time, but I know he's talked about it and talked about it with me back in the day. But we call that, you know, technobabble, and we all make fun of it when it got crazy on Next Generation. And so much so that everybody, all the writers, kind of got sensitive about it and tried to scale it back. Now, it lived anew on Voyager, but you're absolutely right. On DS9, which was the original, let's try to not be so much TNG, they were really determined to do that. But the first couple of years when Michael still had the show, it still creeped in.
It still creeped
in,
yeah.
It still crept in, and he was – but he was also pretty self self-derogatory about it. And he said, yeah, well, some people even call it pillar filler. So. Huh. But it does creep in, and they had to be able to manipulate, you know. And of course, you know, Colum had experience dealing with some of that too. But it can be a stumbling block to actors that never thought they had to hang their hat over.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. It did become kind of a badge of honor for Ira, especially after he became the main showrunner, to really tamp down the. You know, if you're going to do it, you know, they didn't do time travel shows. It became a badge of honor for them to try to not ever go to any of the memes. Like when they do have a holodeck malfunction, the holodeck is not malfunctioning. It's actually the savior of the show because the runabout explodes and they're storing the patterns until we can figure out how to get them back to their holes. So the transporter becomes a hero, but it's also the crux of the plot problem, you know.
Exactly.
So here they're trying to do. They don't like doing time. Their time stories are either were actually in somebody's mind. You know, it's not even real time travel, or there's something bizarre. And then the ultimate show on DS9 or the fun show was Trials and Tribulations, and all it is it's the Bajoran Orb of Time.
Right. You've got a built-in answer right there.
Through
time.
No. You know, the worst it got was maybe on where they're at the Bell riots, and they're talking about
past tense
chronometric flux, and they're beaming through it, and they're doing the test beaming and all that.
That one,
that's about as wild as it got. After
played
the
around a little
years,
bit there.
So.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one last character to close out here. And this is the one casting moment on DS9 that happened after you were firmly entrenched there. That's Nicole DeBoer as Ezri Dax. What did they look for in filling in that character for one final season and making that transition with the symbiont there?
Oh, this is, I remember this like it was the other day, because I was the first person to interview Nicole DeBoer, and it was in her trailer, and because I tease her about this all the time. It's like, remember who your first interview, remember who made you, who put you on the cover of the first mag? You know, oh sure, Jerry Ryan could have a million, of course that was a few years later, but could have a million shows, covers. She was, you know, had that childlike look. And she could play teenagers up into her 20s. Mm-hmm. And she was a big star on Canadian television. And I can't remember the name. There was a show in Canada, something like The Cube or something. It was kind of like a Twilight Zone surrealist show with running characters, I think. And she was a star on that. And Hans Beimler actually knew her and had worked with her either on that show or something else. Sorry to be fuzzy and hazy on details, but...
Well, it's Canadian stuff, so I understand.
So it doesn't really matter. Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea what it's even about. So, your Canadians are going to love me now. It started off as a character concept. And when Terry left the show and they were debating what to do, well, it's kind of like Doctor Who. It's like, well, of all the characters that are ready made to continue only differently, it's Dax. It's a Trill, right? It's a joined Trill.
Right.
Have a new symbiont host. So the whole backstory of the character, almost wrote itself. But then the only question left is, well, what are we going to do for a host? We're going to have a male instead of a female? Are we going to, you know, and going to a male versus a female looks good, you know, as a case study. Let's go from female to male for contrast. But when you pull back and look at the mix of the cast itself, right, you've only got one other?
Yeah, just Kira.
One other female regular.
You know, in the titles.
Right.
So, yeah.
One other regular female. So you really want to keep another female regular. So if you're going to keep it female, then what are you going to do? Well, you know, Jadzia had gone to joining school. She'd gone to the Trill Initiate Academy, yeah, you know, and despite the bumps in the road, she had trained for it and had wanted to do that. So instead of having the well-trained one, let's have the reluctant one. Instead of having the one that's been around, let's have one that's, you know, more of a more childlike innocence and all that, not a child. And when they came up that, when they went that direction, Hans said, oh my God, I've got this great actress. And I'm trying to remember now if they even bothered to read other people. But since it was like last season,
they basically had her in mind. It feels like they just had her send in a video quickly, yeah, or something, if I remember correctly.
They definitely had her in mind. Hans was pushing her from the beginning for this. They kind of wrote the part for her, I think. So mm-hmm. I'm not consulting anything here totally because I didn't think about doing Ezri. But I just remember that being very strong. It was he had worked with her, they brought her in, they all loved her, and then that part was they wound up spending way more time on that than anyone even dreamed of. I mean, the poor regular cast the last season between bringing a new regular in and and it was not like Catherine, it wasn't like Dana Muldoon on the second season of Next Gen. It was not like Pulaski, because go back and look at the credits on Next Gen. Pulaski is never in the opening regular cast. She's always in, and you know, she's down in the Whoopi Goldberg area.
Yeah.
She gets and also starring blah, blah, blah. She's always up front with the guest star. She's in a featured guest star spot, mm-hmm. but they never made her a regular, maybe on a trial basis or whatever. But Nicole DeBoer is out front in the regular, you know, in the regular cast, up front above the line, as they say. She's going to get her residuals at that rate. So, and she's in every episode. So the amount of time they spent on developing that character with a precious few shows dwindling down that last season, and then you have all the, all that, you have a whole show dedicated to Nog and Vic Fontaine, you know, I mean, they spent so much time with the recurring. I mean, I felt a little sorry for the regular cast. Like, gosh, we're winding up our series and half of these shows aren't about us, or they're about 15 people, or they're about 30 people. And we're a sliver of screen time and development time right here along with our 30 well-known recurring characters. So anyway, it was a crowded pool. And the fact they spent as much time on Ezri that last season as they did was kind of amazing. I bet I think she had no idea it was, you know, she's like, well, I'm walking into this the last year. I'll get a few crumbs here and there and whatever, mm-hmm. maybe a show or two.
Yeah.
But I think she was, you know, thrilled and tickled and a little maybe terrified at the beginning right. of coming into an established family. You know, it's always, as an actor, it's like anything. You walk into a new job where everybody knows each other already and you're the odd one out, mm-hmm. especially when everybody started the company except you. It's not right. just, I'm the last one to come in.
But that actually works well for the character in Esri's case because
oh yeah
that's her actual situation on the station. So
right. So they used it to, you know, they used it to best advantage.
All right. Well, we've run through all of the characters except Worf, who we're not going to talk about because he was fully established by the time he came over to the show. So there's really nothing to talk about.
Oh,
there
that guy.
In terms of casting,
he made a killing for them to convince him to keep putting the makeup on every day again.
Yeah, so, I remember when they were. I remember the rumors, and then I remember the confirmation, and I remember how I felt about it, and now I know how I feel about it now, which is that I think that DS9 is where Worf belonged the whole time, because the character really came into its own on DS9.
Yeah, but Jadzia or Kalar?
Well, I have to go Jadzia, personally.
Now, you're just saying that because you had way more hours. You had barely 2 hours of guest starring episodes for Susie Plaxen versus, you know, the whole accidental development. Because, their chemistry was a complete accident.
Right.
When he first picks up the bat, you know, when it's Way of the Warrior 1 and 2, and they first throw, you know, it's like, okay, now we have to have the first Worf scene with Kira, the first Worf scene with Quark, the first Worf scene with Odo, mm-hmm. and the first Worf scene with Jadzia is pretty much that Batleth, or the second one maybe. Mm-hmm. And they watch that scene, and after a couple of those, the writers are sitting there going, "Holy cow, look at this!
Yeah,
you know, we can't ignore this."
Well, Worf was
was very organic, is what I'm saying.
Oh yeah, yeah. And Worf was very impressed with her very, very specific tastes in Batleths as well. So. When she requested the Batleth from the computer, and then the computer was like, yeah, okay, I get it, Batleth here. So it just gives her a standard Batleth.
And that is something that by that time, you know, in the show, Terry was so confident. She told the writers what to write into the part so she could do that and attract Michael's chemistry on camera.
And the other thing here is that I would be a little bit worried that Kalar might hurt me. And if I were going to go Susie Plaxen, then it would be Solar and not Kalar. So.
Well, you know, they love Solar too because they always kept having her be mentioned, you know, like on the PA or something, on the intercom.
And we continue that by having her be mentioned on the network all the time. So,
Thank you. Yes. Besides the books. Here's one other little tiny, tiny note that I just came across going back through the call sheets. Not a regular character. But obviously, one of those recurring, Nog and Gul Dukat are the only two recurring people. Well, and the Kai, but she died later, Opanka. But Gul Dukat is the only, aside from Nog, are the only two characters that were recurring in the pilot that were in the finale, both. And something that's interesting, and I think this has to do with the makeup somehow, but there actually was another actor cast to play Dukat that filmed for a couple of days, an actor named Michael McRae. And he filmed for, what is this, day 5? And he filmed on day 6? Yep. And day 7. And one of these might have been he was called, and then it didn't happen. But by what are we on here? But by day 9, Dukat's being played by Mark Alimo.
You know, the whole Gul Maset, Gul Dukat thing, of course, gets explained in the DS9 continuation in the novels.
What do they say? I know I remember reading about this, but I didn't read the
Maset novel. Is actually Dukat's brother, I believe. That's why look just alike. So. Easy
right,
solution.
And it's the brother that got the crappy, you know, milk carton uniform painted brown.
Yeah. All right. Well, Larry, thanks for joining me today and talking about casting and character development on DS9. And before we go, is there anything coming up anyone needs to know about?
Wow. Well, I think by this time we've closed out our tour, the LA to Vegas Trek film tour. So that's happening. But no, it's we're just in the middle of summer season here. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And we've got Comic-Con, BayouCon for me in Louisiana, and then back home for SoonerCon. But then, of course, we've got Vegas coming up, the Vegas Creation Trek, the week after Comic-Con. So it's only 2 days for me in San Diego and then the tour and then Vegas. And if I've survived, I'll try to try to rebuild. The other exciting thing is that I finally got to say it in public, but I'm going to be a guest at Destination Star Trek in London.
Yeah, that's very cool.
In October, which will be cool. And just coming from FedCon in Germany, that was great. And no, we've got the Trekland trunk is kind of laying low at the moment with all this convention craziness, but we'll be back with that. And of course, if it's Vegas, that means there'll be another Trekland on Speaker CD debuted for Vegas. At least that's the rumor.
That is the rumor. I have heard that rumor.
I run around with those people, and that's what they tell me. So if they get off their butts and get it done, which will happen. It will happen. So hopefully sooner than later. And I know there's probably more things going on. Oh, I really should mention this too. There's two really cool nonprofits that I'm working with this year. And one of them is the Hollywood Sci-Fi Museum, which did a small Kickstarter that did not make. And but that I don't want the world to think that that's the end of it, because that was for some bureaucratic procedural stuff. I can't say them now, but there's some really exciting partnerships and some things that are in the work that are going to go that to make that through. So if anybody saw not quite make the Kickstarter, don't think that that's the end of the project. All the donors are still going to be with us when we come back around. But it's a project that's only a fraction of the whole budget. It's going to need a lot more than that. And there's corporate donors that are standing by to jump in. It's just going to, you know, be a little bit of a mid-course correction on that. But that's going to be huge. And I have a lot of illustrious people with me on the board for that. And same way with another out-of-the-box thing right now called the Enterprise in Space. That's really not – there's a Facebook page up for it. But basically, it's – finally putting an orbiting craft named Enterprise into space, into orbit. And this one will be loaded down with tons of student science experiments that have to go through a competition.
And, oh, good. I thought you were going to say a bunch of science students.
Yeah. It's those disrespected Ferengi scientists that are
loaded down
home
with them.
Finally. Yeah, loaded down. Let's blast them into the sun and get rid of them that way. No, it's really exciting. It's very cool. It's a combination. It's an actual space mission that will launch and go into orbit and then be retrieved. And it's not even leaning on people to fund it, because it'll have a lot of big science donors too. But there'll be a way people can be a member and have their name go into. Anyway, it's really exciting, and that's really going to be launched at the end of July. But we just now got approval as a National Space Society project, so we have their their umbrella, and maybe sometime we can have a couple people come on talk, because it's got a breadth of people that have won awards who are working on it, a lot of legitimate space and project manager and engineering people, and it's a huge educational outreach to student K through postgrad is the science payload outreach
that
for that
pretty much
science
covers
teachers.
All the bases, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's another incredible, there's been such a, it's like Star Trek and NASA. There's always such a sci-fi, real space, love affair, mutual love affair going back and forth. And the Star Trek, I think more than any other sci-fi franchise, since Star Trek is rooted, we've talked about this, since Star Trek is rooted in our history, in humanity, it's not Galaxy Far, Far Away, long time ago. It's not, Firefly. It's not whatever, Galactica. It's us. And we draw our roots from it. So there's a special kinship between and there always has been from the 60s and, through Enterprise especially. They had NASA, astronauts, Mae Jemison, the whole shebang. And it's one more way of using science fiction, and to what degree we're allowed to do it legally, Star Trek. But everybody gets it. The orbiter is going to be called Enterprise. It may be the NSS Enterprise. But it's just using that kind of inspirational focus to get kids and get people involved, and just be kind of another way to, somebody said there's never been an actual Enterprise craft in orbit since the shuttle Enterprise never actually flew. It was a test craft. So, drop shift. So that's really exciting. That's a 4-year project. So that's going to be getting going this summer. So you know, I guess keep up with me at Trekland and Larry Nemechek on Twitter, because it's going to be kind of an out of the box year going forward here, but still plenty of, you know, fun Trek stuff. And there's I'm not in it, but there's a new Star Trek Continues episode that's just come out, and so I invite everybody, the Mirror Universe, fairest of them all. So I invite everybody to go over there and, you know, go to the Facebook page and all that stuff. That's some fun too. Yeah. But a lot of exciting stuff happening across the board in fandom. Star Trek, in case you noticed it, Star Trek is not dead.
It's far from dead.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Even as we wait for the next format of a series to take its shape, because I have no idea what might happen there. But while we're waiting on the official Star Trek to come back to film, you know, versions, and we wait to see what Bob Orsi does with the third JJ, you know, the third Bad Robot movie. There's so much else out there to keep people, to scratch the itch. So
lots of it for sure. All right. Well, thanks again, Larry, for spending so much time with me today and talking about these characters.
I start off thinking about DS9 like, well, they're kind of cut and dry, but then we get into it and there's still plenty of interesting wrinkles to talk about.
Well, I told you, Larry, you said you're not sure how long we can talk about this. And I said, when we start talking, it tends to go on for a long time. So,
oh, did it again. Oh, look, 7 hours. Okay, damn.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, Larry.
Okay, Chris, we'll see you next time.
Well, there you go, everyone. That is the second part of the discussion that we had about the casting of DS9. I hope that you enjoyed it, and maybe we brought to the surface a few new tidbits of information. I'm really looking forward to the day when we get DS9 on Blu-ray, and we get those wonderful special features where we have Ira and Ron and all these guys sitting down together talking about writing this show, because there is so much there that has never been revealed before, I know, and I just cannot wait to hear it. Well, the casting of DS9 was a great conversation, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network over the past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I mean, like it's been talked about, you know, by Shatner, that he's like, oh, I wanted to have the Enterprise find God or something like that. Well, how does that work?
Well, right.
You know, and it's like, well, it doesn't work the way you're doing it in this movie.
Earl Grey.
What if it was like a geeky tween boy? Data, where are you? They're just like, shut that off.
Mr. Data, I've got a problem.
The Ready Room.
When they finally do get rid of Decker, it's on Kirk's personal authority as captain of the Enterprise. And, like, it seems to me if you're, say, a captain in the U.S. Navy and an admiral takes command of your ship, you can't just, like, get rid of him because of your personal authority as captain of the ship.
The Orb.
And again, it's something, as, you know, as we said before, the system is not set up to allow him to express that idea in any other way. But by the spectacle of this trial, which would presumably be impossible to hide, it is a way for him to express this alternate viewpoint that maybe the morality of his society is under threat.
To the journey! We are here to talk to you about a very heavy-handed topic. This is kind of a dark area for us. No, I'm just kidding. We're talking about death and Voyager. Commentary, Trek Stars.
When they thaw out the pod people and they say, why, what year is it? And Data says, why, it's the Earth year 2364. I fell off my chair 47 times. It's like, they just put the... Oh, my, okay.
Warp 5.
Archer doesn't close himself off to any possibility. He takes the evidence and comes to the best choice that he can. And that's not always easy for anyone, but that's the kind of person that Degra is, too.
Melodic Treks.
In fact, it had two versions of the theme, one which ran from seasons 1 to 3, and one which ran from season 4 onwards. Now, some people prefer the first music with the poignancy of the lone trumpet, others prefer the second incarnation.
Continuing mission.
If we were to sort of able to rewrite the canon, the uniforms we've got, they were the uniforms in the middle of Enterprise and TOS, but because they were designed during a time when peace wasn't as prosperous as it is in the original series, the uniforms did have a bit more of a militaristic look to them.
Literary Treks.
You know what I love about comics, though, sometimes, is what happened here in this panel with Beverly and Troy. clearly Troy's stunt double wandered into the scene.
I was going to say, is that Troy?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. We try to cover every facet of Star Trek here on the network, and you can get our shows pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts, whether that's iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone. We're on Spreaker. We're also on Swell and on SoundCloud and many other places. Just search for Trek.fm or the show you want to listen to, and you should find us there. And another way to sample these shows is to subscribe to the Trek.fm Complete Master Feed. This is a special feed that contains every episode of every show we do. It's a really easy way to sample the other shows that you may not listen to right now, and to find out what we're talking about and what you like, and which shows you might want to pick up individually. You can find that in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Swell, various places. Just look for it and tune in. All right, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, I would love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that same username. And if you want to find Larry, his username is Larry Nemechek. Very easy on Twitter. And you can look up Larry Nemechek's Trekland and other places on Facebook and on his website. And then my usual co-host, who is away right now, Matthew Rushing. If you want to catch Matthew on Twitter, his username is MattRushing02. If you want to find the network, you can find us everywhere as well on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/TrekFM. On Google Plus, just search G Plus Communities for Trek.fm and you'll find us there. We also have a contact form on our website. That's at Trek.fm/contact. That'll come to both Matthew and me by email. And we have forums on our website as well at Trek.fm/forums. You can even send us a voicemail if you look on the show page on our website for this episode. In the left sidebar, you'll see a big block right there with a widget that lets you send us voicemail using your webcam's microphone or your smartphone or tablet microphone as well, and you can upload it to us from there. Another way you can share your thoughts with us, which we would really appreciate, is if you leave us a star rating and a written review in iTunes, and you can also leave written reviews on Stitcher now as well. We would love to hear from you and know what you think about the show, and it also helps other Deep Space Nine fans find the orb as they're looking around in these different places. Before I let you go, I would like to tell you about our sponsors for today's show. First, there's Audible.com. They are the best source for audiobooks you're going to find anywhere. They've been my personal source of audiobooks for the past 14 years. I have hundreds and hundreds of audiobooks in my library from Audible. And as a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a trial to see just how great Audible is. All you need to do is to go to audibletrial.com/Trek.fm and sign up today. Choose whatever book you like. They have lots of Star Trek books there. They also have new releases and current bestsellers. They have lots of classics, books across just about any genre you can think of. And you can get that free. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose. You get to keep that audiobook. But by trying out Audible, you really will be helping us keep the orb coming to you. Because if just one of you tries Audible, the money we receive from them almost covers the cost of hosting and distributing the orb for one full month. So that's a huge help to us. And you're going to be getting something great in return as well, free audiobook. But when you stick with them, you're going to be getting great selection and great prices every single month as well. So check it out, audibletrial.com/TrekFM, and we really thank Audible for their support of the Orb and the network. And we'd also like to tell you about TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. When you join TrekFan, you'll explore new places and you'll learn new things, and you can also collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives, and you can even win great prizes along the way. But not just prizes, you can actually really expand your own horizons. For example, Samuel Cummings of Livonia, Michigan, just got his technician license thanks to the program, and also Teresa Watkins of Atlanta just got her flight operations challenge taken care of a couple of weeks ago. And these are regular Star Trek fans, just like you and me, that are doing these amazing things thanks to TrekFan. And the things I just mentioned are due to programs they have, like the Trek Fan Qualifications, which are monthly, and they have flight operations, they have engineering, they have communications. It's a way for you to take your love for Star Trek and put it into action in a way that helps you grow and also helps the world. They also have other programs like Starfleet Academy, where they will send you a free Star Trek novel, just a random Star Trek novel. They'll send it to you. You just write a review of it and then give it to a friend when you're done. You don't even need to send it back to them. And best of all this stuff is absolutely free. All you need to do is to go to fm.trekfan.org and join. And that is a special URL that lets them know that you heard about it here on The Orb and Trek FM. So please be sure to use that, fm.trekfan.org. And we really thank Trek Fan for their support of the show and the network. Well, thanks for listening today, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the two-parter with Larry. Matthew should be back next week, although it might be one more week. And when he gets back, we'll reveal what his whole big secret Section 31 mission has been. And we'll get right back to When It Rains, the fifth part of our look at the final chapter. If Matthew's not back next week, I'll be back with another show for you on a different topic. And I hope you'll join us then, when we once again gaze into the orb.